It's the Masters, the season's first major, a tradition unlike any other, and a time for players to outperform even their own high expectations. This takes focus, commitment, and trusting the best golf ball for your game. That's why the majority at Augusta National will rely on the Titleist Pro V1 or Pro V1X. They deliver superior performance, consistency, and unrivaled control. Titleist, the number one ball at the Masters, the number one ball in golf.
Hello and welcome to episode 115 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast series from Golf Australia magazine, exploring the eternal question of just what draws people so strongly to this game. Rod Murray's my name, and this week's always a special week in golf, with almost everyone who's anyone at Augusta National for the Masters. Among that crowd is our very own John Huggan, who reached into his contact book and lined up some special interviews to celebrate the week as we wait for the first tee shots Friday morning Australian time. On this first of those chats, Huggy caught up with two-time Masters champion Ben Crenshaw. And if you know anything about golf and anything about the Masters, you'll know that that is always worth listening to. So enough out of me, and let's get straight to John Huggan in conversation with Ben Crenshaw.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast, a special one this week. Here we are at the Masters, and I'm sitting opposite a man steeped in Masters history. He's even got his green jacket on just for us. Ben Crenshaw, what was and is the thing about golf for you?
John, I was introduced to the game at an early age. My father played golf. My brother, 15 months older, played golf, and we fell into a group of young kids who wanted to play, but we were guided by a man named Harvey Pienick, who gave us a great gift. He encouraged us to play, but he wanted us to be in the game and learn how to say nice things to the members,
right,
and learn to get along socially.
Yeah.
I look back at the game, and I, especially during a week like this, I see people all over the world that I played with and played against. For instance, I just saw Roger Davis this morning from Australia. Mm-hmm. We played many times down there, and it makes me understand that it's a worldwide game. People have had love for it for hundreds of years. There's a lot to be learned about it every day you play. Mm-hmm. I think it's the social aspect of the game that's as lasting,
right,
and tradition.
Yeah.
There's no other game like it. You know, it's funny. I just did a small piece for Royal Dornoch.
Right. Okay.
And to think that golf was played in the 1600s,
yeah,
there.
I know. Yeah.
It's very much attributed to your country, Scotland, that makes it what it is. It's, yes, it's competition, but it's enjoyment of the game, but it's respect for the rules. 1457,
yeah,
an act of Parliament.
Yeah.
Largely the same today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to get to this much later in this interview, but since you bring that aspect of the game up, do you think some of that is being lost at the moment because of the way things are, especially at the top end of the game where you were involved?
Well, I think, John, if anything, right now, I have to be real honest. I'm very unsettled with things, yeah, in the world.
I think we all are, yeah.
I'm going to say a few things about Jackie Burke tomorrow night, who lived to be 100 years of age.
Yeah.
He told me was such a sage about so many things. He said, you know something, Ben? He said, if people went by the rules of golf, there wouldn't be the problems that we have today.
That's a fair point.
Because if you break a rule, there's a penalty involved.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just that simple.
Yeah, and you would own up to it.
And I don't think I don't see that so much anymore, but we as golfers understand that, and we believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
We want to carry it on.
Yeah. And I share your worries, if you like. I mean, the way the LIV Golf thing and the PGA Tour and the European Tour, I mean, the viewing figures should be telling them something. I mean, people are switching off in droves right now. And, you know, they're a bit turned off by all this talk of money from people who are already multimillionaires. You know, that's the last thing you want to hear if you're struggling a little bit.
I must say, I think you know me. I'm pretty sentimental about the game. Mm. I think the thing that's most hurtful to me are the friendships that have been broken.
Yeah.
About it. Those, in other words, the lasting things, you know, they can talk about money, they can talk about this and that, but when you talk about where you are in life and how you, what your occupation is and how far you've come in the game, you don't want to see those relationships go away. Mm-hmm. I'm very traditional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody said to me earlier this morning when I said to them I'm doing a podcast with Ben Crenshaw, the reaction was, well, try not to make him cry.
As the old saying goes, I cry at supermarket openings.
Yes, yeah.
But I do.
Do you think a lot of this, what the way you are, comes from Harvey Penick?
In very much so.
Yeah,
he was a very soft-hearted man. Mm-hmm. He so respectful about other people. I never met a kinder gentleman in my life. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that the lady pros who went to him, you can't believe the way they talked about him in their career. Betsy Rawls and Mickey Wright, and all these, Kathy Whitworth, every one of them just said, what a kind person.
Yeah, I went to see him way back in the day when I was over here at Golf Digest and with Bud Schrake, who did the Little Red Book. And there was a problem with, Harvey had a problem with me in that, he was a bit deaf, as you well know, and my accent didn't help, and he couldn't understand a word I was saying. It was very funny.
Bud Schrake did one of the best jobs of personifying who he was in words, and he put together a beautiful little book, their little red book, and it's universal.
Yeah.
That's the kind of person he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was an enormous fun talking to him. He struggled a bit with me, but it was great. It was a really good story. I mean, he was a lovely man, as you say. So, and obviously, he loomed large in a sad way, obviously, when you won your second Masters.
It was surreal.
Dan Jenkins' opening line of his story when you won there has still lived with me. He's in a big blow to atheists everywhere was his opening line.
really Dan good. Jenkins
yeah, absolutely. How do you explain that? I mean, you're getting into, you know, mysticism almost that week.
There's no way to explain it. I do know this, that at certain times that last round, I felt like I was reverting back to just playing like a kid again, which was, what a time to have that sort of feeling.
Well, I've had pros tell me that they spend their working lives trying to get back to playing the game the way they played as a kid.
Yeah, and it was a reactionary. I was just playing each shot and not getting involved with too many extraneous thoughts. Yeah. It was just, I don't know how you can explain things like that, but I do know at the end, I just said to myself, you know, that was in honor of Harvey, and it just happened to be me that was helping people remember Harvey Penick.
Yeah,
and for that, I'll always be proud.
Yeah. I remember Chuck Cook, who you all know well, telling me back then that he was on the plane with you and Tom Kite when you went back to Austin for the funeral the week of the Masters, and he said that you were, you know, in bits. And Tom was more stoic. I mean, people handle these kind of things differently. There's nothing, no wrong or right. And Chuck had in his mind you missing the cut and Tom having a chance to do well. And it was completely the opposite in the end.
Well, I was very observant of him. Yeah. And he knows us both. And that's the way we are.
Mm-hmm.
To flip the script there is just amazing. But when you play your best, you just don't have these thoughts. Mm. You just react, and it just happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing thing to see. I mean, you know, to experience it must have been incredible. Anyway, I've jumped ahead of my order of play here, as it were. I want to go back to, you know, we touched on the beginning of your, you know, you playing with your dad and all the rest of it, but you were a complete prodigy as a youngster. I mean, is that fair to say? I mean, you were cleaning up at that age?
Well, I think it really helped of having junior golfers around you that you got it in your mind's eye how to play and what those kids were doing at the time. And you knew who was playing the best. It pushed you. You said, well, God, if I need to play better, I need to do these things better. As I say, Texas was a hotbed of some really good golf at younger ages. I remember going to, junior high tournaments, high school tournaments, and then to go to the state junior tournament in San Antonio at Breckenridge Park for the Texas State Junior. You could see these kids from around the state, and you said, God, these guys can really play.
Yeah.
It helps you to see that. Mm-hmm. Helps your competitive juices, and I just kept bringing along.
You stood out even amongst all that, though.
Well,
put your false modesty aside here for a minute.
I was playing good golf. Yeah. I was playing good golf. My dad was a good player. He was a good athlete. He played baseball. He was a catcher at Baylor University, but he obviously knew Harvey very well, but kept me on the right track. He wasn't hard as nails on me, but he kept pushing in the right way. But I was learning. I was learning, and adaptability and how to not only play well in Austin, Texas, but start to go to different places and how to react.
Yeah.
So it was helping as a rule.
It says a lot for Harvey Pinnick. I mean, many things, great things you could say about him, but the fact that he taught you and Tom Kite, two very different people, very different golfers, and was able to be successful with both. I mean, that's the mark of a great teacher, isn't it?
A wonderful man. He said, Tommy, he said, I'll see you on the practice tee, and Ben, you just go play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he knew I kind of enjoyed practice, not near as much as Tom. Tom is still hitting golf balls these days.
Yeah.
And I still love to play. Yeah. And that's just the way we were.
Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing that people, if I say Ben Crenshaw to the average golf fan, the first thing that's going to come into their head is putting. Could you always putt?
I really enjoyed putting. Yeah. And it was funny. As a kid, I would go out and play and always end up on the putting green. And there was these four gentlemen who were always putting in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I kept watching them, and Harvey'd come down and he said, Ben, that's what I want you guys to do. Play around and come. I want you to end up on the putting green and putt against each other. Make it a game.
Yeah.
Putt for something, whether it was a Coca-Cola or whatever. And I loved it. I enjoyed putting. I enjoyed trying to figure out breaks and strength of a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And putting against good people too. But once again, that competition in some form helps you.
Yeah, I don't see many people, ironically, putting the way that you did these days. It's old-fashioned the way you putted.
It is. Yeah. I love to watch a ball break.
Yeah.
I was always trying to keep the ball on the high side.
Yeah.
In other words, Harvey said, give luck a chance.
Yeah.
That's one of his favorite things was. Some people were bold putters. I never saw two more bold putters than Tom Watson and Arnold Palmer.
Mm.
I mean, they were always forceful.
Yeah.
And I was more of a die putter. There's a lot of different ways. I think growing up on Bermuda grass greens, some coarseness helped you make the ball roll on them. And I thought, God, the first time I saw some bent greens, I couldn't believe how good they were. Mm, and I said, God, this is
easy.
But no.
Yeah. And did that help you here? The fact that obviously putting is such a big part of this tournament. I mean, it must have been an advantage for you.
It does. I played 9 holes yesterday, and some of the putts that you have, there's no other better feeling when you're in contention, John, than to retrieve a 2-putt from an odd place.
Mm.
It gives you such confidence to save a stroke and keep going. But you have to, these greens are most imaginative in the world. It's part of the huge defense of the golf course. It has everything to do with combating length and how you play it and how you position the ball and the fairways.
Is the green,
but the greens are unbelievable.
Yeah, are they? Is it more so now? Are they faster, appreciably faster now than when you played?
I'll tell you this. I felt a little firmness in the ground yesterday. Mm-hmm. I was here 3 weeks ago on a holiday with a few friends, and they're much different today. They're polished.
Right.
And I hope we don't get any more moisture, but you have to imagine, you have to know these greens. It takes a long time to learn. That's why Fuzzy Zeller's win, without, he just listened to his caddy. Mm-hmm. I think the guy's name was Jeremiah.
Right.
But that's one of the great caddy.
Yeah. They always have great names, the caddies.
Trips of all time. You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah. Have they gotten too fast? Some people would argue that they have.
They get close. Yeah. Certain flagstick locations are lethal. Mm-hmm. You know, there's golf courses in the world. This was an unbelievable attempt at combining a comfortable game for an average player and for the tournament golfer as well. Jones always said you can only do that by tightening the flagsticks in certain locations, but the tilting nature of the greens.
But you can play for bogeys here quite easily.
You can.
If you want to. You know,
you can, which is
It's like St. Andrews. St. Andrews is the same.
Yeah. Well, St. Andrews loomed large in Jones's career, and he still says that that was the thinking man's course forever. You could learn I'm one of those people at St. Andrews. I mean, if you played the rest of your life, you learned something about it every day you played.
Yeah.
And there's no other course like it.
You must have been licking your lips first time here then. You must have thought to yourself, like Seve did. Seve's always famously said, "Oh, I'm going to win here." You must have had the same kind of feeling.
Well, I thought I could do well if I just kept patient and learning it. And I had some wonderful caddies from 1972 to 1976. And that's when I met Carl Jackson, and I got together with him, and we finished second that year, albeit a mile back of Raymond Floyd. But we both were excited, but we both made sort of a pact to learn it together.
Yeah.
And after all, Carl grew up here in Augusta.
Yeah.
He first caddied in this tournament when he was 14 years old.
What year would that be?
He caddied for, I'll think of him. He was 14 years old when he caddied.
But that kind of
coat and tie on when he played. Really, I'm trying to remember who.
Well, that feeling about the golf course that you had and Seve shared, it can work both ways. Because you were thinking, the anticipation, you can get ahead of yourself a little bit. I mean, obviously, you were low arm here the first 2 years you played. So obviously, you had success, relatively speaking, early. So that must have helped, I would have thought.
A player like Seve, I know that when he first saw it, it gave him the freedom to highlight his many arsenals in his game. Long hitting, strong hitting, but his touch, touch was magical.
Yeah.
And it would allow him to show his skill.
It played to his strengths.
He relished that.
Yeah.
I still think that he was the most exciting player I ever saw other than Arnold Palmer.
But of course. Yeah.
Watching Seve was a revelation to see. You knew exactly what he was trying to do to the ball. And his body language was so good.
Were you getting to the stage where you were almost getting a little frustrated by the time you did win?
Well, it was close, but I just knew I wasn't doing the things that I needed to do. I needed to hit better approach shots. I needed to drive better, do everything better. But I had a hard time being patient, let's say.
The gentle Ben name, it's like the Big Easy for Ernie. It's not quite the reality sometimes, is it?
I very frustrated at times. My temper got the best of me at times, no doubt. Mm. It's very hard to stay patient in this game.
Mm-hmm. Especially on this golf course.
Oh, well, you know what? To me, it's so spacious. Sometimes your mind wanders because you have that much space out there in which to – the acoustics of this course, there's no other the sounds are no other, like no other course in the world. You kind of know what everybody's doing. Mm-hmm. You know what whose yell that was, which is kind of eerie and spooky, and it makes you try different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did a piece earlier this week that came out on Morris Bembridge, who 50 years ago shot 64 in the last round here.
Yeah.
And I'm doing two or three podcasts this week, and I'm going to ask this question in each one. Do you think that the equivalent of Morris Bembridge today, who was a short hitter even relative back then, could shoot 64 on this golf course now?
Exceptional. There's lots of added length. You know, I kept looking at the second hole and kept looking at the fifth hole, and appreciably longer. It is, and seventh hole is not anything like it was in the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's a very tough hole now. That would be exceptional, but I think it's not apt to come off with a person of very average length, let's say.
How do you feel about that? I mean, the golf course has changed enormously over the time that you played in the Masters, or since then. How do you feel about that? I mean, there's two sides to this argument, and I wonder where you sit on it.
And they've done a heck of a job to keep up.
Mm.
But, in my career, I never could believe that over half the field now can pitch the ball 300 yards off the tee.
Yeah.
I never dreamed that that was it's just totally different than my day.
Yeah.
But that's what you do hope, though, John, is that the thought of playing the shots doesn't change. And the probability and what you want, in other words, the players of today and the players who played it yesterday can have some of the same thought processes as you go along. As you know, this course dares you to play shots, and it's thrilling when it comes off and gives you confidence, but it's debilitating when it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And Jones was after a thinking man's course, and he and Dr. McKenzie did a brilliant job of keeping it so.
Yeah. I mean, they followed the principles of St. Andrews pretty closely, didn't they? I mean, big white fairways, but if you drive it, you can't just drive it anywhere. You've got, and the closer you drive to the trouble, the more advantage you get with the second shot. I mean, it's basic stuff, but it's how it works, isn't it?
It is, and it's once again a lifetime. But I think Jones was such a brilliant mind. He said it was the one course that required you to really think, and that's what appealed to his senses. And was a great hallmark to not only Jones, but Dr. McKenzie. To have something that combined, once again, both rewarding and strategic play, touch, it comes together here.
What's your favorite shots out there? And we'll get to favorite putts in a minute.
I know this, that two of my favorite greens in the world are number 5 and number 14 to me, because they represent St. Andrean greens.
Yeah.
And I keep, every time I get on those, both of them, I just scratch my head and I said, how did they, this is so much, the upslopes and then the tiers are St. Andrews. St. Andrews is very closely.
Yeah, I mean, that's that little slope at the front of the green. It dictates everything, doesn't it?
Where you want
your drive to be, where you want your second shot to, everything. You know, it's so
Jones
simple.
Always wanted, he said, he really thought that there's no, he wanted people to understand to land the ball short and let it run up. That reminded him of St. Andrews, no question. But 5 and 14, with 14 is a different proposition. You can carry it up there if you want to.
Yeah.
But number 5, many times you have to feel like you go up to it.
Yeah. Well, I like to, my favorite holes are always the ones where you've got the option of running the ball in. If you want, you know.
Once again, that strategic design.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your favorite shots then?
Yeah, well, that's one number five. That is still puzzling. It's unbelievable. We remarked yesterday. I think it was in 1995, the year I went. Jack Nicklaus made two twos on number five.
That's right. Yeah.
That is just unearthly.
I know. Yeah.
Not possible. Yeah. But he did somehow. Yeah. It's always, you know, the 13th and the 15th hole. It's just so much. 15 is elevated, and you see that green down there, and you hope you've got the right club in your hand. I can't get there anymore, but it was always a troublesome thing to pick a club there.
You
want to land it just properly.
I must admit that it's hard to imagine a better hole than the 13th here.
Well,
when it plays the sort of when you've got the decision to make on the second shot, that's the whole thing, isn't it? Really,
it is. Yeah. It is, and such a daring tee shot to hit it close to the corner, and then the second shot's a little problematic on something. It plays a little more uphill than you think, and elevation wise, but once again, thrilling. You see some incredible things happen there, and you see some bad things happen there too, of which I've been on the other end of that.
I'm sure, yeah. You play here long enough, you're going to, something's going to happen, yeah. And what about your favorite putts? There must be some putts out there that...
Oh, I once had a daydream that no one was around, and I could dump a shag bag of balls and go out to the front of number 14.
Okay.
And just start putting and chipping up to that, to various pin placements. Mm. It's such an unbelievable green. It's fierce. You know, people say, well, God.
Reminds me a bit of the 14th at the Old Course.
Very much
in so. That big bump in the front there, right in the middle of the green, middle of the fairway in front of that green is not the place to be most of the time. You want to be way out somewhere. Yeah.
Way right and way left.
Yeah.
You do. And there's advantageous, like you say, on both sides of 14 as well. It's a wonder. It's a wonder, that green.
So just to sum it up then, is the golf course better now than it's ever been? Or is it simply, has it been modified out of necessity? Would it have gone this way had the ball not stopped going as far as it does?
I'll say this, John, that when I first started playing here, they mowed everything. Hmm. It was wall to wall. There was no long grass at all. It was just, and it was meant to be firm and fast. And if you hit an errant ball, it was liable to run into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It was allowed to run into trouble. Yeah. I think that's one of the different things about it then as opposed to now. And they had to do some unbelievable things to the golf course to combat how far people hit it now. But I think now, to me, I did see vestiges of it yesterday. The ball was running quite a bit, and I said, this is more like it for today's player, because I did see vestiges of if they played a ball offline, it would start running and it would go out, which I think is the way it should play.
It would be more difficult.
But today, it's a bit different proposition, no question.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how headlong changes are necessary to sort of combat the game. It's just amazing how everybody is just so long these days.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see it played in the proper way, though, no question.
It's the Masters, the season's first major, a tradition unlike any other, and a time for players to outperform even their own high expectations. This takes focus, commitment, and trusting the best golf ball for your game. That's why the majority at Augusta National will rely on the Titleist Pro V1 or Pro V1X. They deliver superior performance, consistency, and unrivaled control. Titleist, the number one ball at the Masters, the number one ball in golf.
How much of an influence has this golf course had on your design philosophies? You and Bill Coore are, you know, rightly revered for some of the stuff that you've designed. And it seems to me that the strain of St. Andrews Augusta runs through a lot of what you do.
Well, we think about it a lot. And we only hope that it reminds people of a strategic golf course. Obviously, one of our tenets is to leave things alone, leave nature alone, pick out a good piece of property and let that dictate its problems. Highlight those, what you see in the field, but always give people a chance. I've always said it's a very easy thing to make a really difficult golf course.
Yeah. Easiest thing in the world.
And that's not what you want.
Yeah.
Once again, St. Andrews, if you think about it, a lifetime study, there's a million ways to play it.
Mm-hmm.
But it only gets better when you know it.
Mm-hmm. For my likes, I'm kind of the same philosophy as you when it comes to this, but I think the elimination of the exciting recovery shot is madness. I don't understand why you would ever do that, but people do. I mean, the U.S. Open, traditional U.S. Open setups completely eliminated that.
Yeah,
I never understood that.
It's confining.
Yeah.
And extreme penalty, after you see a shot played, and you say, well, that's... But here you always had a chance. You always had a
beautiful lie. Yeah,
and
it brings so many numbers into play. I mean, if you're daft enough to have a go at something, you might make an eagle, but you could make eight. But if you're pitching out, you're going to make a four or five every time. It's boring.
Well, you're right.
Yeah.
It's a totally different proposition. It escapes people attention. I think when they play it for the first time, they think it's much easier than... My standard rote, 30 yard fairways, rough on either side, and it's just a different way to play, different presentation.
Yeah. So what advice do you give people? I'm sure you've been asked, if they're coming here to play for the first time, what's the best advice?
I think this, not only green, you can't play enough approach shots around and on the greens, but note how the elevation change can affect the nature of the shots. If you play downhill, it plays a lot shorter.
Mm.
Uphill plays longer, obviously, but trying to fit yourself to the actual ground itself and the slopes, it's very, very difficult. Sometimes you feel like you're a little off balance when you're over the ball, and that's the sloping nature of the property.
Yeah. Does that apply to even the top players this week?
I think so. Yeah. I think you can. Always work on your balance.
Mm-hmm.
But learning those shots takes a lifetime, although Fuzzy Zeller proved us wrong.
Well, there's always an exception that proves the rule. It's like when you do what I do for a living, the number of sentences that started with the exception of Jack Nicklaus, comma.
That's right.
I mean, he didn't even count,
I always think of a line that Jack always used in preparation for many, many years. He'd tell the press, the greens are approaching tournament speeds. Something like that.
Yeah. Anyway, what do you expect to see this week? I mean, what are you looking forward to?
I think someone who keeps emotions intact, it's hard to do. I must say, Scottie Scheffler, the way that he plays, he's got a great arsenal, but it seems to be a very even demeanor.
Mm.
It seems like not much bothers him.
Mm.
And that pays dividends around here. But I think the youth of the game and people who don't know much about certain young players, wow, there's some unbelievable kids coming up. The week sort of reveals itself in these – youthful players, and they're coming to the front.
Mm-hmm.
People from around the world.
Yeah. At the other end of that scale, I think one of the great things that I think Augusta National gets right is the fact that like yourself, and I bumped into Ian Woosnam and Marco Mira in the space of 20 minutes this morning, and Tom Watson was standing right there, and and Fuzzy Zeller walked past. That, to me, is, I'm at an age where that sort of means more, I think. But still, I think it's really important that that, you know, that you're here, you know, and to tell us stories like you're doing this morning. You know,
well, it's a fraternity. It's a culmination of knowing each other and playing against them and learning the game, watching the game. And we're only just too thankful to be in that room up there. I mean, I look around there every time we start the Champions Dinner. I look for people from around the world. Mm. We have the Spanish, great Spanish flavor this year.
Mm-hmm. You can look forward to some paella.
Oh, my gosh. It's, what an extensive menu.
Yeah.
And then you see Jose Maria Olazabal, and you see Sergio, and you just John Rahm is just such prodigious, prodigious talent.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody goes through the ball any stronger or more forceful than him.
Yeah, he just hold back.
Unbelievable.
And he doesn't take it back too far either.
No, but God, he gives it a thrash.
Yeah, yeah.
Great man.
Hey, I'm going to ask you this because it's on the list, and it's, I think people would be interested in what your thoughts are. What do you think of LIV Golf?
I just, someone with my vintage, the way that we played our whole careers, in a four-round competition, meaningful. Competition is different than wherever you go around the world. It's a tournament and it's finality to it.
Yeah.
You play against great players, but it's a different way. And I'm not saying distasteful. That's not it. But I don't like it that friendships go by the wayside, and I just don't like it. It's not good for the game in that respect. I don't know. I don't know if it'll ever get together with the PGA Tour or the European Tour or wherever you play. I just don't know.
Does the source of the money bother you on a moral aspect? I've said this before on here, but I thought the mistake that Jay Monahan made originally was to make it a moral issue and not treat it as a business. It was like The Godfather. It's not personal. It's a business decision. That, and to me, because if you take it down the moral avenue, you're kind of stuck. You can't change your morals, but you can change your mind in business. And how do you feel about that whole scenario?
Thing, and the money's one thing, and it's totally something that nobody's ever seen. But obviously, they've been successful in other endeavors in sport. Golf's a traditional game, and I don't like it that part of it's changed. You want to reward the best. And it's the money part of it is, to a lot of people, the biggest part of it. I don't know. It's just not different. It's not the way we learn.
But the Saudi, you know, what goes on there, that
you can't,
you would distance yourself from that. I mean, yeah, I think if you're in business, I think you have to.
Yeah, you just can't. There's no monetary-wise, there's you're going to lose in that game.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Yeah, I mean, Jay Monahan was right about that.
But I don't know. You always want to see the health of the sport continue. You don't want to see anything threaten it.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see it over, basically? Is there a way back? I mean, I'm going to put you in charge. You're king for a day. what would be your solution to where we are right now?
I think you really have to sit down hard on both sides and say, look, what are we trying to do?
Going to have to compromise both of them, aren't they? Yeah.
I don't know whether that's going to happen. Who knows? But the two sides need to meet and know what they're into, what they're doing, and how it's affecting people.
Yeah. I mean, I do wonder, as I say, without compromise, that there's no easy solution.
No.
They're going to have to bite the bullet, both of them, both sides. So I don't know. Anyway, it remains to be seen. Anyway, we're moving along here. I was intrigued by this. I hadn't quite realised how much I want to play you in a playoff, Ben, because your playoff record is absolutely appalling. You've never won any.
Spotless.
You've lost.
Spotless.
Lost everyone. I need an explanation for this.
I've lost in a million different ways. Like I say. guys have played better. I've completely blown up. It's crazy. Not one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 0-8.
0-8.
Yeah.
0-8.
Yeah, it's appalling.
Spotless. Yeah. Can't say much for that, John.
No, I mean, but on the other side of the coin, let's say, on the plus side, you how much pleasure do you get from winning something like the Irish Open?
Oh,
I mean, that kind of shows you game can travel.
You know, I played with John Carr yesterday, my old friend.
Yeah.
And his brother was Roddy. I played with Roddy, and this was 1976 at Port Marnock. And I got to meet the great Joe Carr. Mm. And then what a wonderful man he was. He had the best physique I've ever seen. He stood straight up, just wonderful, 8-time British amateur champion. Mm. And to win on that golf course was just amazing. There was a guy that chased us down the stretch, and he was a hurling player. His name was Jimmy Kinsella.
Yes, I remember him. He played the European Tour.
He was a hurling player.
He was the pro at Skerries or somewhere like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. I got a note from one of his friends the other day, and I said, "Yeah, hell yes, I remember Jimmy Kinsella. We played together at Port Marnock. It was so much fun." And I came back the following year, and Hubert Green beat me. Mm-hmm. I finished second to him, but Port Marnock was wonderful. Yeah. Got to meet the great Harry Bradshaw.
Mm, yeah,
back then. So you meet all these characters.
Christy O'Connor, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Christy. I played with Christy.
Yeah, now there's an possibly apocryphal story that goes around that it's attributed to you about playing a practice round with Christy in Ireland at one of those events. And he's in the middle of, you're in the middle of the fairway, 150 yards or whatever, and you say to Chrissy, "Well, what club should I hit here?" And he then goes through the bag from driver to putter and hits everyone in the green. Is there any truth to that? I'd like it to be true.
Christy's one of those players that just played the game, played with his hands. Mm. Beautiful, beautiful. And I think he played that shot with a few clubs. Mm. Right. In other words, you dummy, what are you even asking me for?
Yeah.
Which was great. He played well all over the world. Mm-hmm. He was a great player, wonderful man. But
he could drink.
I was very, very young and knew nothing.
Yeah. Well, you did all right.
When you start playing links golf, you start to learn.
Yeah.
Pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I was a betting man, you know, early on would have looked at you and thought, well, this kid's going to have a chance of winning Masters the way he putts. And also your kind of feeling for the game and the way you played outside the putting would have suggested the Open would have been the most likely one for you to win.
Well, I tried to learn in watching people, but the way I played, the more comfortable in certain situations I was, so there were certain tournaments that I could possibly excel.
Mm-hmm. What were your best chances?
I had the Open Championship, 1979 at Royal Lytham.
I thought you might mention that.
Seve outplayed us.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of us finished second in 1978 at St. Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
I played, but you know, so I played with Aoki 4 days in a row there.
Really?
We had a ball together to watch his short game.
How was his English?
Not bad. Yeah, I could get along with him, but he was an old friend from Japan. But to watch him, he loved playing at St. Andrews. He could hit all these shots too.
Yeah.
Turnberry, I was leading going into the last day, and Tom Watson just killed everybody. Made a lot of mistakes, but I came close there, and came close in the PGA and the U.S. Open. But always thought that my best chances to win a major was here, and thank goodness it did.
Yeah, is that your biggest regret that you didn't win an Open or another major?
Yeah, I really want.
I mean, you obviously lost a playoff at the PGA as well. So
yes,
yeah, one of those eight playoffs. You know,
one of those 0 days. That was disappointing. But no, I would have loved to win the Open Championship. And my friend Tom Watson's 5 and should have been 6, which was amazing.
Yeah. Hot. Yeah, I can still.
But he's the kind of player who
Yeah, I mean,
he excelled in it.
Yeah, he didn't mind the weather. You know, he just, I've heard him quoted on this. He didn't worry about the wind. He just tried to hit the ball solidly.
Yes, you know,
that was his philosophy.
I played with him at Port Rush. That's one of his favorite courses. Before one of the Opens, and went out, and it was just a vile, vile day. And I'm just suffering. And it was about the 12th hole. I said, "Tom, don't you think we ought to go in?" And he goes, "Yeah, isn't this great?" And I said, "Well, there you go."
Yeah, it does help.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But he hit it solid.
Yeah. But the reason I asked that was I've written down here that you were second in five majors before you won one. And that was what led to my asking you, was a little bit of frustration setting in?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I was getting close. Mm-hmm. I was getting close and getting frustrated. And as I said, in 1984, when I won here, I kept things together, kept my emotions. It wasn't so much up and down like I usually do. I was always up and emotional and getting mad and try things, cost you a lot of different ways to debilitate to yourself. A golfer never knows. I was beginning to wonder, no question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't see it, it doesn't.
But things happen always for a reason. My mind always goes to that putt you hold on the 10th green in 84.
Oh, gosh.
Ridiculous.
I look at that and I say, how in the heck did I ever hold this putt?
Yeah.
And I really would have killed for a two putt.
Mm.
Because I didn't want to drop any shots, and it was so weird. I birdied, I think, 8 and 9 that day and faced this putt. And I said, well, don't drop a shot now. Get this two putt. And somehow it went in. I was so excited I had to calm down for two holes.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
It was crazy.
Do you remember who you played with that day?
I played with the young boy. I'll think of it in a minute.
He did all right.
Played with Nick Faldo the first time, 84, and I played with. I'll think of it. I can see him.
I was talking about 84. It was.
That was Nick Faldo.
Yeah. I think that Sandy Lyle said the same thing. He played with Jack Nicklaus when Jack won in 86 in the last round, and Faldo, I think, learned from watching how you did. You know what the things that you did to win. You know, the people, they can learn a lot if they pay attention. I was thinking.
Yeah.
Does it seem like a long time ago? 40 years.
Yeah, 40 years is a lifetime. It's funny. My father used to play in this tournament in South Texas. And then they called it Life Begins at 40. But to think back. When I was playing nine holes yesterday just for fun, I walked around here and I said, how lucky am I to join these guys in that champions room to be able to play here and think about where you've done, what you've done, and to think about being a champion the rest of your life is something else.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, everybody wants to know what goes on inside that room with the dinner. I mean, and you guys are the only ones who ever know, so it's just how it should be.
And there's certain eras that, I can tell you this, I can tell your listeners that Sam Snead told the filthiest jokes I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
And it was enough that he'd tell a couple, and Byron Nelson would stand up and he said, that's enough, Sam. But to see it all happen, unfold.
Yeah. Well, Ian Wisdom told me one this morning that you could never repeat on air somewhere. So, he told it at the dinner once, he said.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But that's part of it.
Boys,
that should be part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So. But it will be fun. It'll be fun tomorrow night to listen to John and to be proud of his Spanish heritage and to be proud of his fellow cohorts who won the champion, who were in that room.
Six green jackets now between them, Spaniards.
That's right. And to, in ways, to honor Seve as well.
Yeah, yeah. It was a big thing for him last year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's missed, isn't he? I mean, I speak as a European for once. You know, he was the leader of everything. Oh. He was the first one that came over here and won and showed the rest of them that it could be done, kind of thing.
Oh, you know? Yeah. He was magical, just magical.
Yeah. I wanted to, you know, spend a few minutes before we finish, Ben, on talking about the Ryder Cup. It's 25 years now since you were captain. Yeah. Ridiculous week, by the way.
Oh, God.
I can still see you wagging your finger. Oh. You know, I've got, what made you say that? Because it didn't look good, let's be honest.
Yeah, there's certain things that were happening that I don't know. It just was a feeling that something told me that we're going to be all right there. Something's going to come out in the plus column. I'm thinking had to do. I kept thinking about Francis we met and how many unbelievable things happened to him.
Yeah.
With on that the playoff golf course, with Vardon and Ray.
Yeah.
And on that golf course, I don't know. There was something about that course that I thought – that course was going to...
You're right. I mean, it's a great sadness in a way, I think, and you probably share this, is that the fantastic golf that your team played on the Sunday got kind of lost in the midst of all the stampeding across greens and stuff.
I know it. There was something about that course I thought it was going to take care of us. And you saw some things that you were completely out of the ordinary, and then that happened on 17. And to happen to Jose Maria Olazabal, who's whom we all love.
Do you ever look back on that now? And I've asked
but
you
that was
before.
The damnedest. I mean, nobody in the world would think that putt was going to go in for him.
Oh, I know. Yeah,
we lost our brains.
Yeah. Do you ever look back and think, you know, this would have been a big call and a brave call that if you'd gone and said, right, pick it up, you can't putt after that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I.
And you might have been the one man who could have done it, you know, the way that you feel about the game.
No, we lost it.
It's a big question, man.
No, well, we lost it, and it was something that we had to apologize for.
Mm-hmm.
We plainly lost it. Nobody ever.
Yeah, I mean.
It was such a shock.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, no.
It was a shame in a way that the golf got kind of lost in the midst of all that, you know. And I speak as somebody who was partly responsible because I wrote about it as well. And I wrote about the stampede before I wrote about the great golf, you know.
Well, it's understandable when you got away from it and you say, well, that was not clearly not right.
Mm. How do you look back on your playing career in the Ryder Cup? Because, again, not the greatest record.
No.
I'm sorry to keep bringing this up, but I need some explanation for that.
I had a few good moments, but largely I was not a great contributor, let's say.
No.
The game with Eamon Darcy, that was just the cake.
Well, to explain for the people who are listening that you broke your putter.
I did.
In the singles at Muirfield Village in 87, yeah. How did that happen?
I three-putted the sixth green there, and I was so mad, of course, and I went off the edge of the green, and there was this, you know, in Ohio they have these buckeye trees. They have these buckeye nuts. So I just tapped it pretty good with my putter head, and the shaft broke, and I went, oh, my God, now what? And I'll never forget going up to the seventh tee and or the next hole, eighth hole. I putted with a sand wedge on the next hole. Walked up to the eighth tee, Jack Nicklaus comes up. He said, how's it going? And I said, under my breath, I broke my putter back there. He just looked at me and said, what? Yeah. And I said, well, the way things are going, I don't blame you. But Eamon later said, he said, I thought Ben was trying to slow the ball on the green. They were so fast. I thought he was trying to slow the ball down.
Yeah.
I ended up putting with a one iron.
You didn't putt too badly.
And made a couple of putts. Carried him to the end.
Yeah.
But Eamon and I always laugh about that. He made a great putt on the last hole to beat me.
He did.
Stuffed me out.
Yeah. How do you explain? I mean, it's an obvious explanation is that they had some great players, but the Europeans have won so many Ryder Cups when on paper their team hasn't been as good as the American team, but they've won far more than you would expect. I mean, is there an explanation for this?
No, I've always just thought that they play better together than we do as a whole. Over the past history of the Ryder Cup, we're more sort of individualists, let's say, but a team aspect and knowing what to do is, it's, I'd say y'all's end is much better mm-hmm. from a long track record than ours. You know, the Europeans have unlocked the code, and you can see it. You see it in the women's too, collectively. It's a tough thing to break, no question.
In their minds, they're always the underdogs, which I think helps in a way because they're playing for a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans, conversely, then get on the defensive because they're seen as the favorites. And they, oh man, if we lose here again, we're going to get slaughtered in the media and all that stuff.
Skewered, yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's all part of it.
It's fascinating. It's a fantastic contest. Yeah.
There's nothing better than match play, of course.
No.
No. Just to get an insight into somebody's soul. You know.
Oh, exactly. You know. Bernard Darwin always, he said, what did he say? He said, match play, or I can't remember who it was. Match play is like, I'm trying to remember how he said it. It was perfect.
Wow.
Metal plates were scored.
I'm just impressed that you're the first person on any of these podcasts, a former player, who's been able to quote Bernard Darwin. I'm impressed enough with that.
I think he's far and away the best writer. It's unbelievable to see what he wrote about architecture, players. He wrote with such emotion. You know, he'd always chastise himself.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to you wait to read his books. You had to have a thesaurus next to you.
Yeah,
it's just beautiful language.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah,
dry wit, British droll wit. Yeah. Just wonderful.
Yeah. I want to end up, Ben. You're the champions' dinner. It's a kind of ultimate boys' club, which is slightly ironic for a man who lives with a. all these women. You're the only male in the house.
You're right.
What's that like? What's the contrast like with that?
Oh, it's a chance to get out and be with.
Now be careful,
with guys man. that you just absolutely love and love to be together, and then. You know, the same night, Julie, my wife, has a little club over there off to the side with some of the champions' wives.
Oh, tomorrow night?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So, I didn't know that. Yeah.
So it's kind of fun that way, too. Right. But no, I live a – I'd kind of do what I'm told. And I need to. And it – we had I have three wonderful daughters, and my youngest is getting married in September, and you know I've thought about this for a few weeks, and I said, Julie, I tell you what, I could say in the Champions League, you know, my youngest is getting married in September, and I could ask John Rahm for a loan.
Very good.
Maybe I can get a loan.
Yeah. Have you got your speech ready?
I've got a lot of things together.
Yeah.
Pretty well.
Yeah.
Jackie Burke stories and right. The reasons why we're in there. We just enjoy each other. And
Jackie Burke was great. I went to Champions once to interview him when we talked about he was captain of the Ryder Cup in Muirfield in 1973, and I got him talking about that, and some of the stories were, he was so funny.
Oh.
You know, he had no respect. He just treated them all, you know, like school children almost.
Yeah.
And Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer, I don't care who you are, you know, sort of thing. He was brilliant.
He's a cat.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
No, we'll have fun.
Anyway, and I want to finish off by saying that you've just turned 72. Which I refer to as level fours.
Level fours.
So how do you feel about the future for Ben Crenshaw? What's left?
Oh, well, I'm very happy to you know, apart from other things about my wife and family, but I've got the most wonderful business partner in the world, Bill Coor, mm-hmm. who not many people know, but You know, it's ironic that Julie and I got married 37 years ago, and Bill and I formed a partnership 37 years ago. But we've had so much fun. We've had so many happy moments building courses, and we've been fortunate to build in lovely places. And we only hope that people enjoy what we do. But it's with a lot of fun and respect about what came before us, what goes into trying to make a good golf course, but I'm very thankful for that.
Mm. Is that how you want to be remembered?
Yeah.
Providing fun for people?
Yes.
More than your playing career?
Yeah, I think it probably lasts longer than your...
Yeah.
It's a lasting thing.
Mm.
You put something on the ground and it's there.
Yeah. How do you look... Very last question. How do you look back on your career? I'd like to ask people, relative to par, where were you at the end?
I don't know. I was under par sometimes, but I couldn't always hold it. I was maybe close to par.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hopeful for better.
You were fine until the playoff.
Yeah, don't get me in a playoff.
Ben, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You're welcome.
You're a great
it's
man.
It's been
thank
a great
you.
Fun. Always. We always have good talks.
And I hope you have a great week. Thank you. Thank you. Cheers.